Being a CISO is like waging a never-ending chess game against players you don't know, can't see, and attack without warning. On this podcast, cybersecurity experts have a pragmatic dialogue on cyber risk, current attacks, and security trends. Welcome to the CISO's Gambit.
I'm joined today by Darren Kerb, EVP and Chief Information Security Officer at Guaranteed Rate. Darren is a senior executive with over 20 years experience across information technology, consulting, and financial services. Darren holds an MBA from Northwestern University, Kellogg School of Management, and a CISO Executive Certificate from Carnegie Mellon University, Heinz College of Information Systems and Public Policy. In 2023, Darren was named Chicago CISO of the Year. Darren Hurd, thank you for joining us today on the CISO's Gambit.
Sean, thanks for inviting me. Looking forward to it.
I got to spend a little time in Chicago not that long ago, and I wish we would have had an opportunity to run into each other during the last Avant back in November.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised we didn't. The Avant events are great for local technologists, local CISOs to gather in what I like to say is talk shop. And so I think that the events do a good job of mixing networking and good topics to discuss.
Yeah, you have an amazing community over there. Probably the most vibrant one I've been exposed to, and I get exposed to quite a few. So I think it's something to be proud of. You see the mutual respect amongst all the leaders across some of the world's largest companies, and they're all just like, hey, how can I help you out?
Well, I'm glad you said that. There are several people that have, in different parts of the country, in different roles, that have said that the Chicago security network is very, very strong, very vibrant, very active. And I tend to hear that more and more often now. And it's hard for me to envision anything else because it's so good here.
Oh, I can take you to other ones if you like. You'll definitely appreciate what you guys have built there. It is truly night and day from many of the others. And not to knock any of the other communities, it's just different in Chicago.
We're all a helpful bunch.
It's that Midwest camaraderie, man. I think it's awesome. Darren, you're the CISO of Guaranteed Rate, which is one of the largest retail mortgage lenders in the United States. Could you tell us a little bit about your role, some of the things that you've observed over the years regarding shifts in the industry and how it's affected not just your business, but your approach to security?
I'd be happy to. Just a bit about my background, my role. So I have a CISO title, but it's a bit broader than what might be found in other orgs. So I'm responsible for security, also for technology, governance, risk and compliance, business resilience, our data office, and our tech business operations. So it's a bit broader role, but I think what the anchor there is that intersection between security, risk, data. So that keeps my team and I very, very busy on a day-to-day basis. But the mortgage industry is a very different industry than a lot of others. There's some different challenges that are unique to our industry. And the way I'll frame this is when times are good, they're very good. And when they're bad, they're very challenging. And if you think back to a few years ago, 2020, 2021, interest rates are down, economy's doing well, and we couldn't grow fast enough. And we tripled the size of our employees, quadrupled the size of our tech teams, and did acquisitions. And it was just tons of great challenges on that path to growth. And then rates start creeping up and the housing costs keep creeping up and that volume drops. And then now we're figuring out, all right, how do we adjust to the challenges of the marketplace? And we're, cutting expenses where we can, both in technology and people. And the reason I describe that is most industries don't go through multiples of increases and decreases in such a short period of time. So I've had to adjust to security program to those realities of volume changes and acquisitions and threats, in our industry. It's like very focusedly how we manage the demanded priority of work with them and how we build that program very, very purposefully with focus in what we're in that limited amount of resources that we do have.
So that's a fascinating perspective. The fact that you can have your business effectively booming. I'm going to be a little hyperbolic here, effectively booming. And then all of a sudden it's not, and it's almost the inverse. That is a pretty crazy concept. And how the heck do you create a risk plan around, because some of these factors are directly out of your control as an organization, right?
Yeah. I mean,
you guys don't set the rates. You're subjected to them, like kind of like anyone else is, but how do you get ahead of that?
I guess the way I sometimes frame it is, I always like the definition of the very succinct definition of grit, which is accepting your reality and choosing your response. So we have to accept our reality of the rates are what they are. The economy is what it is. It's a lot of this is out of our control, but then focusing on what we can control. And the way we look at it is that when you're growing, you're adding assets. That's in people, that's in technology, it's in partners. And where you're what you're trying to do is identify and build systems that can scale with that growth. Because you can't, you know, if you triple the amount of employees you have from several thousand to 10, 15, 20,000, manual processes don't scale. Sometimes even automated processes, some bend, some break. And what you need to do is really identify what are the systems that you could put in place that can scale with that growth and still protect those assets, those partners, those integrations. So that's like one way, you know, I think about how to manage through that growth.
Technology-wise then, is that what has driven aspects of your adoption of cloud technologies? It would seem that that would be a natural fit given the nature of the business. Is that just too obvious or deeper than that?
You're 100% spot on, Sean. When, you know, the program we built here at Guarantee Rate, you call it, you know, cloud-based, but really what that means is if you think of a cloud that has elasticity to scale up when volume is up and down when volume is down, the ability to do so quickly, the velocity of that change. Our program is built around our ability to scale and contract with the business so that we're not having to go from, we have a bunch of hardware that we need to then buy and scale, and then the business contracts, and then we're sitting on all this hardware that we have nowhere to deploy it to. And that's where we've leveraged cloud providers, partners, et cetera, to help our program scale and contract as the business does.
Yeah, you know, I don't miss the days, which I know a lot of our colleagues out there are still dealing with this. You're sitting at the dock waiting for some appliance to show up or some server to show up because you got to get out of the box, racked up so you can start depreciation on it.
Be much. And actually, to just give you an example, when you know, COVID went down, our VPN infrastructure, which we had employees working across the country, we had a fair amount of capacity, but we had never tested everybody working from home, which is, you know, probably most companies, but we did have a fair amount of people mobile and using our VPN. But when COVID happened, we ran into some capacity constraints, like a lot of companies, ordered the additional hardware, deployed it, whatnot. And you know, we got through it. At the end of the day, we're able to successfully connect, you know, employees to getting access to the resources they need. You know, fast forward to today, we don't have a VPN. Our access to our environment is all zero trust based, software based, agent based, and we don't have the constraints that we had just a few years ago with the need to manage and deploy hardware into different, you know, data centers across the US to support VPN.
So on that VPN front, when did you make the decision, you know what, we're getting off of this boat, we're getting in a different, because this boat's got a huge hole in it. I'm talking about traditional remote access style VPNs. What was the onus for that? Was that due to the COVID piece, or were there other factors that made the decision even easier? For example, some of the obvious security benefits that can come from it? Or was it truly, hey, we have a capacity issue, we need to quickly address this to keep the business up and running?
Yeah. So the decision was sometime in maybe 2022. It partly was a capacity challenge, but not exclusively. I think the two things that were really driving that change, these three things, but first was when we moved to a zero trust network access and went the direction of Zscaler private access, you all have four points of presence. Those points of presence allow our employees across the US to hop to a closer hub. And as a result, we have a better login experience in, I'll call it snappier apps. So their experience on a day-to-day basis was noticeably different. And we measure that with some of the response times with some key applications. So that was the first thing. Second was around the risk reduction that comes from moving off of a traditional, what is it, VPN technology that's 30 plus years old to something that's modern, software-based, zero trust-based, and the risk reduction that comes through that. So that's better inspection of traffic. That is segmentation of our traffic that we're able to do. There's a large push on that risk reduction front. And then I think the last thing, with the point you started with, was capacity. It's just easier for us to scale up and scale down if it's software-based versus hardware-based.
I'm curious if you've run into this with peers across either your vertical or in others. I've observed over the last 2 months, let's say, that all of a sudden there's this realization for some folks when it comes to their usage of legacy tech like VPN. I'll give you an example. Just about barely a month ago, a large organization that we're all fairly familiar with decided to rip out all of their legacy VPN, and they decided to do it in less than 48 hours. It actually wasn't as traumatic as some folks just kind of had assumed it was going to be. And, we've all dealt with, you got to get the agent out when it comes to traditional VPNs, but in their existing world, they were already leveraging the technology. In this case, it was Zscaler's technology. And the implementation was fairly trivial because they didn't have to deal with the traditional routing and all of that funky stuff that happens when you're doing a remote access. Have you seen that across your peer group at all? Because I'm just starting to see it where all of a sudden, and maybe some of the vulnerabilities that were announced with like Ivanti and some of these others, every couple of months, it's another major provider saying, oh, our bad. But the CISA warning, I can't think of a time, and perhaps your memory is better. I can't think of a time where an extension of Homeland Security said, stop using this technology immediately. What do you make of all of that?
First, I think your perception aligns with mine, which is my perception is that more often recently, there's been more warnings around VPN technology and whether it's, to get off of it, to move, to patch, just seemed like it's dominating more of the security-related events, announcements, patches than you've seen in the past. Talking to peers in the industry, peers in, similar roles, there's a bit of FOMO when you're fear of missing out, when you're like, I'm already on a zero trust network access, authenticating by MFA and soon to be biometrics. And you're talking to someone who has a large complex network that they're still running that's VPN based. And then the conversation veers towards what's the experience like with a zero trust access? And what are the roadblocks or the challenges that they've had with their companies that have prevented them or maybe taking longer to make that transition? But at the end of the day, I think the anchor is like a FOMO because they don't want to be on the old technology that they're having to patch that's complex to build and operate. They want to be on something that's a bit modern tech stack.
In your operations group, does your team have day-to-day break fix on those, back when you had those legacy technologies? Was that your team or was that another organization that owned that?
Yeah, great question. So the VPN technology is run by our networking team, who's a fabulous group of people that manage and build and monitor all of our different branch office network connections. Fast forward to today, the Zero Trust ZPA connection is managed by my team. It, so that went from a networking thing to a security thing that's run out of the engineering, out of my engineering group, and the operations, out of the operations.
Yeah, that has a huge impact on how quickly some of those things move.
Yeah.
In a positive direction when you have the ability to control the resourcing on that.
Yeah. And I think what's also helped is we rolled out, you know, we already had agents on all the desktops for traffic, web traffic inspection. And so extending the capability to Zero Trust Network Access was fairly easy. And we just went, we have a guaranteed rate, is actually a number of companies. We have an insurance company, title company, multiple mortgage originating companies. And we just built, the agents were already out there. We just went company by company, rolled it out, learned a little bit each time, made some adjustments. And it was, you know, really a few people running that rollout across the large enterprise. So it was, for us, from a build and operate standpoint, there's a lot of leverage and efficiencies gained there too.
Now, in a perfect world, obviously, for CISOs with your level of experience, usually you're inheriting a large infrastructure with, not always, but with a significant amount of technical debt. If you could wave a magic wand and start everything over, which I know we've all had to deal with that at some point, how would you approach program development? What would you advise the business? This is a hypothetical, right? So we're not talking guaranteed rate. Based on everything you've learned and all the security successes you've had in terms of programs and building the teams, if you could encapsulate, I don't know, three things that to you would be the core focus of standing up the GRC function, the technology architecture function, and the operational function, what might those actually be?
To standing up a program, this is a fun question. There's something I said in a few different talks I've done, and the way I'll frame it is, if you've ever watched the movie Fight Club, where everyone knows the first rule of Fight Club is to not talk about Fight Club.
That's right.
That's
why we're not talking about.
That's why we're talking about Fight Club. I have a sort of a saying, not to be taken literally, but, you know, first rule of security is to not talk about security. And what that effectively means is that when you're building out a program, you need to not overwhelm your stakeholders in the business with security speak. You need to talk really about what I think are risk reduction, operational improvements, user experience, compliance, things that they can connect with and relate to. Because what that does is it establishes what I think is the foundational for anything is that trust they must have with your stakeholders, who you're serving, you know, as your role in security, but also you need to partner with to get stuff done. So I think, you know, starting greenfield or really whenever you need to do that. Second, and closely related, is working with them to, because every company can be very different as it relates to their risk tolerance. And understanding whether it's a board, a public company, or it's a private company, a family-owned business, that where their risk tolerance is at, you know, how much money are they potentially willing to lose due to a cyber incident, and talking about, you know, the probabilities of different scenarios. So I think, you know, establishing that trust that you can have those effective conversations, talking about risk in light of the business that, you know, that company is operating. Then I think you get to the, all right, so now what do we need to do? We have then get to the brass tacks, if you will, the what's the threat environment look like? What technology exists? What's the people look like? And then ultimately building out a roadmap that pulls together the people, process, and technology that's aligned to that risk tolerance, that's then supported by that trust you've built. That's generally how I would approach it. I have a very, very high level without talking too much tech.
Based upon the difficult situations a lot of our peers are being put in today, for example, being responsible for a particular risk outcome where perhaps they may not have the direct capability to effectuate that change. What do you think about what's happening from a legislation standpoint? And more importantly, the way that a lot of us are being put in, I'm not going to say no-win situations, mm-hmm. but I have heard that kind of rhetoric from a lot of other security leaders. I don't necessarily subscribe to that, but I can empathize with the point that they're trying to make. Mm-hmm. Hey, it feels like we're trying to build this program. It's been stop, start, stop, start. I'm not getting the right support for whatever the reason may be. And it could very well be that they didn't do the three things you outlined, or they did, and maybe the positioning of it, the selling of the approach mm-hmm. might be part of it. What do you make of these new requirements? The SEC has got a lot of people really concerned. And I'm also starting to hear additional pressures coming from shareholders that are saying, hey, our stock just took a massive hit because of this outcome. We're now seeing personal liability become a conversation very differently than it was before, right? Mm-hmm. In your mind, are these things good? Are they bad? I know that those, it's very black and white, but how do you see the shift that is occurring very rapidly, the impact that that's having on the psyche and the ability to execute for a lot of our peers?
Yeah, and I think, Sean, it's a simple question with a very complex answer that I won't likely have. But so overall, that I think myself and people in my type of role, there is more pressure to, of course, protect the people, the assets, the operations of the business, and the government, like the SEC and other, you know, state regulators, other things that are being passed are still good steps in the right direction. But I think at the end of the day, to make a very broad comment, the actions and the outcomes of the government-related organizations aren't doing enough. You know, if you look at the SEC, the recent changes they made, and we're not a public company, so we're not, you know, directly impacted. You know, it's great that we're trying to protect the interests of the investors, of trying to create more transparency around the events that are happening, security events that are happening. And then does have some trickle down effect to, we do business in New York. So we have, NYDFS cybersecurity regulation that fits within that there's some theme. But, yeah, at the end of the day, you're still seeing ransomware attacks up. You're still seeing, you know, operational issues in healthcare, on public sector, financial services. There's a lot that's hit home recently. And I think ultimately the regulations aren't going far enough, fast enough to an extent to set what should be the minimum bar of a effective cybersecurity program for companies in that space, whether it is, you know, healthcare or financial services. And the reason I believe that is because we're still having so many consistent issues across you know, different industries with various incidents. So that's, I don't know, a perspective to have. I think where we've responded well is around getting in front of where these regulations are going, making sure that our program is not just keeping up with the bare minimum, but that we're several steps ahead of where a lot of these regulations are going. And I would that, you know, other peers and other companies are doing not just the minimum, but trying to do more and stay in front of the evolving threats that, you know, that our respective industries face.
Yeah. And obviously we're speaking at a very high level because you and I both know it's a far more complex challenge that we're certainly not going to be able to solve in the span of an hour, but it's interesting to get other leaders' points of views on it. Because I've actually had friends of mine call me up and say, I'm kind of thinking of stepping out of the space. And I'm sure you've had similar conversations, and sometimes it's personal in nature, but now it's like, I don't know if it's really something I want to get tangled up in.
Yeah. And it's a very fair thing to reflect on. And if you're in an organization where now each organization size, complexity, culture can be very different. If you're an organization where it's like, oh, Sean's the security guy, his team has it. And then when something happens, Sean's the scapegoat and his team's the scapegoat. That's not a great position to be personally or professionally. And that's where, you know, if you think of the phrase we all use likely is the security is a team sport. And if you think of the people that should be in your court and helping to manage program, steer the program, support the program, you know, people in operations and finance and risk and compliance and legal. And if you and your respective peers are all aligned on what you're doing and how you're doing, where the program is and what it is today, what it can be tomorrow, but also recognizing that, you know, at the end of the day, it's the phrase, you know, it's not if, but when, and you're not ending up in this as a scapegoat for something that might happen because it was an executive team alignment around the risks we were managing, the program we put in place, the controls we put in place, as well as the trade-offs that we've made and the risks we've accepted. So it doesn't end up at the end of the day, the security incident happening and they're going, hey, Sean, what did you do? Like, well, we knew it wasn't perfect. So go figure.
And that right there is kind of the crux of it. We often find ourselves negotiating how much we're willing to give up. And it's not always couched that way. Even risk models themselves, right? You know, the traditional AIL model that we've all been taught in Security 101, and we try to apply that to reality and we go, oh, none of these numbers make any sense. And any business partner is going to laugh me out the room when I tell them, oh, your potential outage cost is going to be $10 million a minute. And they're going to be like, I don't really know if this person understands how we get paid here as an organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And what are the things I've found that's been very helpful is, you know, tactically the use of a risk register where you can go through this program of sort of see something, say something as part of first line of defense. And we then facilitate a cross-functional discussion amongst technology and business leaders around there's this thing that poses a risk and some scope, some, you know, challenges with it, whatnot. And then what are we going to do about it? So it ends up engaging, using it as a way to facilitate conversation, engaging peers on that decision process. And there's times where it makes sense to accept the risk and for a short period of time. There's other times where it absolutely is not the right answer and get everybody aligned. And when you're aligned, then the execution around, you know, resolving that risk becomes much more effective. But that risk register has helped us facilitate a lot of those conversations.
Your experience and the success that you've had with the way you're communicating out the risk register, are you aligning to a particular framework around risk measurement? I know a lot of organizations will build their own, but you guys actually have actuarials in the business, right? So I'd be curious how that conversation goes down if you're talking to an insurance leader and you go, here's the probability of risk, and they go, that's cute. What's that like?
Yeah, so our program right now is more qualitative than quantitative. We are bootstrapping our quantitative program. It is crawling, but we're making some progress. And the why behind that is at the end of the day, you want to have a conversation that is built on probability of impact and probability of risk. Those types of conversations are easier to have with the business because they understand probability and dollars versus, you know, green, yellow, blue, or green, yellow, red. So we're in the process of facilitating those conversations. As far as a specific framework, you know, we're starting to lean into FAIR a little bit. I think at the end of the day, the industry is evolving fairly quickly where different companies have had different challenges or successes with different models. And I don't think anybody has it quite right yet. Because if someone did, and that way of telling the quantitative story was, you know, just well laid out, you probably see a technology vendor just eating up market share for different companies because they're going to want some of that. But in the meantime, I think we're all just trying to figure that out, figure out a way that we can communicate the rest of the business that's making us more effective than just the fear, uncertainty, and doubt with the color red.
That is very, very true. And the red, yellow, green, I think has been a bane of most security practitioners. Auditors seem to love it, but you lose all the nuance when you take that approach. Are you familiar with the work of Douglas W. Hubbard?
I know Doug. I've done some work with Doug, some presentations. It's been a few years. I actually hired him several years ago. I was at a different company, and he and his team helped build a quantitative risk model for the security program, which was excellent. But yeah, I subscribe to Doug's loathing of qualitative model.
I became a follower of his work. So that's fascinating. You actually got to work with him. And have him as one of your advisors. That's awesome.
He and the team are really smart people that, you know, take the path of least resistance for most companies, which is the qualitative approach. Let's throw something in a low and call it a yellow or whatever, or high and we'll call it a red. And then it makes no sense when you're really trying to effectively measure risk and measure the impact of your controls against the risk reduction. But it's what many companies use. It's a tool we have like right now, but we're slowly getting away from it. But it does take a bit of a runway to get it all, because most companies, most executives haven't had exposure to quantitative risk management in this way, especially from a security standpoint. And so it takes some, take some communication here.
Yeah. Even something as ubiquitous as the NIST standards, right? Mm-hmm. The 853 series. You can take the high, medium, low kind of approach, and ultimately, and this is, I've seen it happen over and over again. You have a third party assessor, if you're working in the feds, it's a 3APO or whatever. Ultimately, it's a qualitative read of how they interpret mm-hmm. it, right? And it's like, I think that's what gets some professionals into trouble and maybe why some organizations are really rethinking how they might go about communicating aspects of the risk that the program, not your program, obviously, but just programs in general, inherit through these other qualitative approaches, which I believe are still incredibly valuable, prevalent, and necessary. The other piece is just something historically we as an industry have really struggled with, because all of the data is locked behind one vendor or another vendor, and there's not a ton of desire for any of these organizations to information share.
You are 100% right, and I think that just makes our job as the security professionals more challenging when we're trying to create an enterprise picture of cybersecurity risk, when the puzzle to create that picture, some pieces exist, some pieces don't, and you don't know quite what you're building. And then you're trying to pull that together into something that's cohesive for the business to then take that, you know, create some awareness, create some understanding, and then be able to digest that, have a conversation and discussion on it, and then make decisions off of.
One of the recent, thought leadership pieces that you published was on adoption of more quantitative measures in the form of both risk and also insights into how technology is being used. And I believe you're doing it through the partnership with Zscaler via the ZDX capabilities and some of these others that have opened up. What has that been like for your team? For those that haven't read your article yet, and we'll make sure to post it also when this episode comes out for folks that want to really dig in.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The partnership's been great. I think you all do a great job of engaging customers, getting their thoughts around how to solve some of our most pressing challenges. And, you know, that's where a lot of the work came out with our Risk 360 in that platform, which you've all to identify risk and articulate it in a way that is actionable. So the way I view this is that from a guaranteed rate perspective, we protect what matters most, which is your data when you apply for your mortgage. And the team, my team, who is one of the most talented teams I've ever worked with, but they're only dealing with so much capacity. And we have this mountain of work we need to get done. We have a limited capacity. And the tools like Risk 360 allow me to do is go, all right, with this capacity that I have, where are my most pressing issues, or a different way to say that is, where is the most opportunity for me to identify spots of leverage where I can reduce the most amount of risk with the most effective use of resources?
Yeah.
So the first thing I think it helps to do is identify where to leverage. Where, you know, is it segmentation? Is it vulnerability or dot patching? Is it there's configuration change? Is it a sandbox change where we can identify if we spend, sometimes go through this thought exercise, an hour a day, a dollar, $10, like where are that limited amount of resources you have, where should you spend it most to then reduce the risk? So the first, again, is to identify where your leverage points are. And then that allows you to then prioritize your resources against those points you want to leverage to reduce that risk. So it helps me focus the resources on pressing areas. And then the third, which has been very helpful, is so, you know, you identify what you want to do, where to prioritize, but you need to communicate the impact you're having. It's not great when you just say, how was your day? What did you do? And like, I did good things. Like, okay, well, I don't know what that means. So communicating that impact to, you know, not just the team, but your stakeholders. And, you know, we made these very specific allocations, resources, problems, challenges we're solving, whatnot. And, this is the amount of risk we reduced in that time frame. And here's where we're at now. And this is the next thing that we're going to work on. So that's how to look at it. It's a little bit of a long-winded answer, but it's been a great tool set for us to use.
That's awesome to hear. That's one of the things that jazzes me, talking with leaders like yourself that are seeing benefit from the things that our teams continue to innovate on. Switching gears a little bit, I wanted to get your perspective on something. I used to be a chief security officer of a student loan underwriter many, many moons ago. And one of the things that you might get a kick out of this, we were required by the feds to maintain wet signed copies of the original. You're shaking your head. I think you know where this is going. The requirement was that we maintained wet signed copies of these loans that had been originated through us and underwritten technically by us, but really underwritten by the federal government. One of the biggest challenges that we had was ensuring that any digital copies, because there was a provision that for certain cases, we did not have to furnish the original wet signed copy. We could provide a true and exact digital copy that had been validated and through this particular system. Something that I've observed across financials, and I don't know if this has been your experience because I've been on the outside kind of looking in and speaking with other leaders, is there's been a tremendous amount of focus on data security in the context of confidentiality. However, I always wonder, well, integrity is a huge part of what we do as well. And we see it over and over again with ransomware attacks. We used to have a lot of fraud that used to occur. We had an entire fraud department that would try to catch these things. And one of the angles that these criminals would take is they would write up a bunch of these student loans, basically cash out all the money that was supposed to go to classes. And then they'd turn around and say, well, you got to be able to provide me. They would often litigate it. And now you have to provide the actual wet signed copy per the law. Mm-hmm. What I haven't seen yet, and maybe it's happened, have there been campaigns to try to destroy the integrity of some of those true and exact copies for the purposes of effectively creating a gap in the ability to collect? And I know that there's safeguards out there for it. Have you seen any movements, either from a threat actor standpoint, is that even a legit consideration today? Are there now countermeasures to prevent that? And is that even something that's necessary in the mortgage space?
So, Sean, that's a great question. From a mortgage standpoint, I have not, we work closely with our SARS team, which is our suspicious activity reporting team. I have not heard of that scenario popping up in any of the work that my team has done with them. We do get a lot of fraud specific to mortgage, like occupancy fraud, as you know, as an example. We have a lot of wire fraud, unfortunately, in our space. Title companies tend to not have the best security, as do some borrowers, as do some, you know, lawyers and whatnot. So that tends to be one of the sticky points that my team gets involved with. I haven't specifically heard around, you know, call it fraud or related to doc management of wet signed copies in order to get out of the payback of the loan.
Yep. Yeah, I'm curious what you discover there, because I keep thinking to myself, I'm like, huh, basically getting the loan written off as a service.
Yeah, that
I'm sure it's been tried.
Yeah, usually the stuff I've seen that gets reported from a government standpoint, not seeing that case come up before.
Yeah, it's probably something just in the back of my mind, because I'm always seeing conspiracies everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, Darren, I really am appreciative of you taking the time and sharing with us your experiences, some of your wisdom. And I truly hope that we finally get to meet in person. Maybe next time I'm in your neck of the woods, I'll reach out.
Yeah, absolutely. Next time you're in Chicago, let me know. It's the next Avanta event, which I think might be in April or May. I'm not sure. It's coming up. And if you're heading this direction, let me know and we'll connect over a libation.
That sounds like a plan. All right, Darren, thanks again.
Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the CISO's Gambit. I'm your host, Sean Cordero. Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this show, please leave a comment and subscribe.
Content on this podcast may contain forward-looking statements that are current as of the date of recording and subject to change. These statements are subject to the safe harbor provisions created by the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Full legal disclaimers are available at revolutionaries.zscaler.com.